Columbus.
Good morning. May it please the court. Judge Rovner, this is the case with the two convictions. So we do want to thank you for hearing these two cases together, as they do raise similar issues. What I would like to say first is that Mr. Yanez Garcia, like Mr. Masak, is a longtime permanent resident. His wife is a longtime permanent resident, and their seven U.S. citizen children live here as well. Mr. Yanez was convicted of two Illinois felony possession offenses of cocaine. One was for 0.1 gram of cocaine, and one was for 0.2 gram of cocaine. For his first offense, he pled guilty to the offense and received first offender probation, which is a unique rehabilitative statute in Illinois. During the time that he was on that probation, he was arrested for the second offense. Later, those two offenses were joined, and on the same day, he admitted the violation of probation on his first offender offense and was convicted at that time. And he also took probation and a few months of Cook County jail time for the second offense. As we've discussed in the Masak case, I'd like to address the issue of jurisdiction first. Our position is not that this court should take jurisdiction because the faster we get this decision, the better. Although for many immigrants in this jurisdiction, that's a very good reason to take jurisdiction. We think the court should take jurisdiction because its jurisprudence says that it has jurisdiction in this case. And it's taken a while to develop that jurisprudence, but what this court has said is that when we're challenging one of the discrete grounds that's in a jurisdictional provision, that is whether you're an alien, whether you've been convicted, and whether the charge against you can be sustained, this court has jurisdiction to determine whether those facts apply. So the somewhat unique issue in this case is that there are two grounds charged. So the question is, if one ground is conceded and the other ground is contested, does the jurisdictional preclusion provision kick in and prevent this court from taking jurisdiction? As Ms. Baldini-Pullman mentioned, this court had a very similar case to Mr. Yanez Garcia's case in the case of Hernandez Mancilla. In that case, the alien conceded one ground and defended the other ground, defending the aggravated felony charge, and this court held that it had jurisdiction to consider the aggravated felony charge, notwithstanding the fact that he admitted the other ground. And we think one of the primary reasons why this makes sense is because there's a difference if you win on the ground that you're defending. If Mr. Masak and Mr. Yanez prevail on the ground that they're defending, there's something left for them. While Judge Keenan, you're correct that they're still deportable on the controlled substance ground, they're eligible for discretionary relief. If an alien were to come here and he defends on a ground that's not going to make a difference, that he's still going to be removable and there's nothing he can apply for, then maybe there's a reason not to take jurisdiction. But here, it's different. If they defend and win, there's something left for them. The other reason it's important that this court consider taking jurisdiction is because there are cases where two grounds can be charged, but sometimes the government's first ground might not be worthy of a real charge. So the government could prevent seeking review, at least in this court, by charging two grounds. And if one ground is defended on and one ground is contested, then the court will never have jurisdiction. So that doesn't mean there might not ever be jurisdiction for review. That might mean that the court would have to channel the case through district court. But why, when this court has taken jurisdiction on so many aggravated felony challenges, whether there's one or two grounds charged, why would the court take all the two-ground cases and funnel them through the district court and all the one-ground cases and hear them up here? It just doesn't make sense. We think that the court should take jurisdiction on this case because of its prior precedent. The other issue I'd like to address is we agree with everything Ms. Baldini-Pullman said on the proper interpretation of the drug trafficking crime statute. But one thing that she didn't mention that I'd like to touch on is the legislative history of that provision. We think it's important for two primary reasons. One, it tells us what Congress really wanted and intended when it first enacted that provision. And that is that Congress had intended from the get-go, when it enacted the drug trafficking crime provision, to capture federal felony crimes. The prior language of the drug trafficking crime definition said any felony violation of a federal law involving importation, distribution, and manufacturing of a controlled substance. What started to happen as that provision got interpreted was that defendants who had possession with intent to distribute, for example, would challenge that they were convicted of a drug trafficking crime by saying, well, it's not actual distribution, it's just possession with intent, so I haven't committed a drug trafficking crime. And while most of those defendants lost that argument, Congress in 1988 said, well, we don't have this problem by having defendants who have a drug trafficking crime, a likely drug trafficking crime, opt out of of being found to have committed one. So Congress amended the statute and took out the specific offenses of importation, distribution, and manufacturing and replaced it with three general federal statutes so that trafficking offenses in general could be covered and there wouldn't be this possibility of escaping the provision even though you had a federal felony. With that change, it's important to stress that Congress still intended that it be a federal felony, not that it be any felony anywhere classified as a felony. And that's important because states have a lot of discretion in determining what's a misdemeanor and what's a felony. So using a federal yardstick, using the Controlled Substances Act as the yardstick, and then holding the state offense up to it, will create much more uniformity and makes more sense. But it was also what Congress intended. And the final issue that I want to address is the issue of that you had asked Judge Rovner on this issue of what happens when you have two possessory offenses. We know that one possessory offense under the Controlled Substances Act is a misdemeanor, but two can be a felony. And there are three issues to look at when you're trying to determine whether Mr. Yanez's two convictions are a federal felony. The first is what law directs the terms prior conviction and prior final conviction. We think state law directs the definition of those terms. We believe that the Controlled Substances Act separates out prior convictions into prior federal convictions and prior state convictions. So when you're looking at what is a prior conviction, you look to the jurisdiction in which the conviction occurred. That being the case, how does Illinois law define what's a conviction and what's a final conviction? Our position is that Mr. Yanez was not convicted of his first offense until he walked into court on May 27, 1999, the same day he pled guilty to his second offense, and pled guilty to the violation of probation of his first offender status. First offender status in Illinois is a very unique, one-of-a-kind rehabilitative statute. We believe that it's carved out of the definition of conviction for general Illinois purposes, for general Illinois law. And as a result, the statute itself requires that a first offender probationary status doesn't end until you either violate it or you go back into court and get your case discharged. So we know that this position is in contrast with the position taken in this court in Lloyd, but we would like you to look at that case again and look at the case law we've cited in our brief and take another look at that. And finally, on the issue of finality, we don't believe that under Illinois law, Mr. Yanez's conviction was final on the day that he pled guilty because he still had direct appeal rights with those running. He therefore didn't have a final conviction when he pled guilty to his violation of probation, and therefore he doesn't have a federal felony. I'll save the rest of my time for rebuttal if you don't have any questions.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Mr. Blumbo. Mr. Buckles.
Your Honors, Jeffrey Buckles from the Department of Justice, representing the Attorney General again. I'd like to respond first to a few things that Ms. Palumbo said. First, on the question of whether Mr. Yanez's first conviction for Illinois, or I'll put it in a more neutral way, whether Mr. Yanez had a prior final conviction at the time he committed a second offense. Ms. Palumbo argues that state law should control whether something constitutes a conviction, and we argued in our brief that was incorrect even before Gill, but now it's perfectly clear that this court held last month in Gill, a case that I submitted a 28J letter on, that the INA's definition in 1101A48A controls whether a disposition constitutes a conviction for immigration purposes or not. Ms. Palumbo does not argue that under that definition in the INA that Mr. Yanez's Illinois disposition does not constitute a conviction, and it's clear under that definition that it does. In fact, the very same Illinois first offender probation disposition was at issue in Gill. So Gill is squarely controlling on this point. I think it's perfectly clear that, as a matter of federal law, Mr. Yanez's first disposition constitutes a conviction. As for whether it was final, if you look at the transcript that Mr. Yanez put in the supplemental appendix, at the January 5, 1998 sentencing hearing on that first disposition, the judge says, correctly, under Illinois law, you have 30 days to appeal the sentence that I'm imposing on you today. Gill governs whether that disposition is a conviction or not, holds that it is. Under Illinois law, you have 30 days to appeal. That disposition was final 30 days later in February 1998. 9 months after that, in November 98, Mr. Yanez committed his second offense. I submit that it's perfectly clear that Mr. Yanez had a prior final conviction at the time he committed his second offense. So even if our interpretation of 924C2 is wrong, in other words, even if the hypothetical federal felony approach is the correct interpretation of that provision, it's perfectly clear that Mr. Yanez had a prior final drug conviction at the time he committed his second offense, and therefore, if his second offense had been prosecuted federally, it would have been a felony.
In your view, does that put him in a totally different position than Mr. Massock?
Well, I think that the difference is that in Mr. Massock's case, the question whether 924C2 includes state felony drug conviction is squarely presented, and it's really the only question on the merits of the aggravated felony issue there. In this case, that question is presented as well, but even if Mr. Yanez's position on that issue is correct, Mr. Yanez is still an aggravated felon under the hypothetical federal felony approach. That's the approach that Mr. Yanez himself is arguing is the correct interpretation of 924C2. Under that approach, Mr. Yanez still loses because he's still an aggravated felon. That's the difference between the two cases. I'd like to respond also to the point that Ms. Palumbo made about the legislative history. The sum total of the legislative history that petitioners here are relying on is a statement. It's not even a statement. It's the title of a provision. It's Section 6212 of Public Law 100-690, and it says, quote, clarification of definition of a drug trafficking crime in which use or carrying of firearms and armor-piercing ammunition is prohibited, unquote. And then it goes on to say what the amendments are. That's it. This is not a case where you have an extended discussion in legislative history, such as in a committee report, that says here's the prior law, here's the confusion based on what Congress enacted previously, here's what we meant to say, this is only a clarification. This is nothing like that. This is a case where you have the paradigmatic snippet of legislative history that isn't even a statement, it's just the title of the provision. And on the other hand, you have the language of the statute. And to address that briefly, the language of the statute does not reflect any intent by Congress to limit it to federal felonies. If Congress had intended only to clarify that 924C2 applied to any federal drug felony, Congress could have left the wording, quote, any felony violation of federal law, unquote, intact in the provision, and simply added involving a controlled substance, period. But Congress didn't do that. Congress could have left the wording any felony violation, unquote, intact and added the statute, the felony violation of which it wanted covered. But it didn't do that. Instead, it changed the wording from any felony violation of federal law to any felony punishable under certain federal statutes, including the Controlled Substances Act. Seventh Circuit to recognize, I submit correctly, that Congress did not limit the definition to offenses punishable as felonies under the CSA. Congress wrote, quote, any felony punishable under the CSA, unquote, not any offense punishable as a felony under the CSA, not any felony under the CSA, not any felony punished under the CSA, or any other variation. And so I submit those cases are correctly decided. This Court should follow them. I'd also like briefly to address the jurisdictional issue again. I don't want to disagree with Ms. Palumbo because I agree with her that this Court should take jurisdiction over the aggravated felony issue and should decide it. I just want to make sure that my argument on that issue is clear. It's that the Court lacks jurisdiction for two reasons here, and the Court is free to reach one or the other or both of them, and the Court can take whatever considerations it deems appropriate into account in deciding which or both of those two reasons to reach. It's no different in principle than the diversity example I gave earlier, or take an example of a case where somebody loses for lack of subject matter jurisdiction because there's no injury in fact, and in the alternative, even if there were, there's no traceability. It's the same as if you dismiss a diversity case for lack of amount in controversy and also no standing. It's not a novel proposition or one unique to this context to say that a court can choose among multiple jurisdictional grounds and reach whichever or how many of those the court wishes to do so in the alternative, as long as it doesn't reach a merits issue before assuring itself that it has jurisdiction. That's what we submit the court should do here. The alternative is, as petitioners counsel have made clear, litigation in habeas, and we think that it's clear that Congress wanted to avoid that kind of piecemeal litigation, wanted litigation to be consolidated in petitions for review. In fact, a section of the INA, 1252B, I don't remember the provision now, specifically says we want all issues consolidated into issues of law and fact consolidated into petitions for review. Of course, the Supreme Court held that wasn't sufficient to abrogate habeas jurisdiction, but the fact remains it's clear that Congress's intent was to avoid piecemeal litigation of these issues, to make removal more streamlined, more efficient, and under the circumstances here, the way to respect Congress's intent on that point, I submit, Your Honors, is to reach the aggravated felony issue here rather than leaving it for litigation in habeas.
How do you respond to the argument that implicit in the government's argument would be the view that an administrative agency can abandon its prior interpretation of a statute, announce a totally new interpretation, and apply that new interpretation to conduct that occurred when the prior interpretation was enforced, particularly in light of the drastic kinds of consequences that you have in cases like these?
Your Honor, I would answer by saying that it is not the government's position that an administrative agency, in all circumstances, is free to do what Your Honor described. The situation here is that the issue before this court is what is the correct interpretation of 18 U.S.C. 924c2. That is a legal issue, the pure question of law for this court to decide. The board expressly disclaimed any obligation, of course, to defer to it because the board does not have policymaking authority to implement that section. That's the provision of the federal criminal law and not of the immigration law. And as the board has recognized, courts are not obligated to defer to it. And the flip side of no deference is that it's not something on which the board has policymaking discretion. On matters where the board or another agency has policymaking discretion, where it's in common language filling in the interstices of a statute or where it's developing policies, a lot of these cases involve the NLRB, cases that Ms. Flambeau has cited. In all of those cases, the issue was one on which the agency had discretion, where there wasn't necessarily a right answer or a wrong answer, where the agency was free to use its expertise, bring its discretion and policymaking to bear, and come up with the outcome that it thought was appropriate. In a situation like that, when a court is called upon to review the agency's decision, there isn't necessarily a right or a wrong answer. Under Chevron, the court often will defer to the agency, even if the court isn't really sure that that decision is correct. The situation here is totally different. There is no retroactive legislation here. This is an old statute, and the question before this court is, what does it mean? This is not a question, like in St. Cyr, of a new statute's application to old conduct. And in the context that we have here of legal issues for federal court decisions, the Supreme Court in Harper, in Beam, in Rivers, and in other cases has made clear that federal courts have an obligation to apply what they believe to be the correct interpretation of a federal statute to all litigants who come before them. And that's the case here. The interpretation of 924c2 is a legal issue for this court to decide. This court has no discretion under the Supreme Court cases to say that the BIA's interpretation is correct, but we're not going to apply it to this litigant because this litigant relied on a prior interpretation.
Thank you, Mr. Buckles.
Thank you, Your Honor.
You have 1 minute, Ms. Pomo.
I'll make 3 points. On the issue of the drug trafficking crime definition, 924c2, the court knows what the former language was, the pre-1988 language was, and the court sees what the current language is. For 12 years, With the current language, the board interpreted that language as any federal felony. At best, it's ambiguous. And if it is ambiguous, we have two circuits following the hypothetical federal felony rule and some sentencing guideline cases, numerous cases, that follow a different approach. If it's ambiguous, we think the legislative history is important, and we think, short or not, the legislative history shows that Congress still wanted it to be a federal felony. The second point is the issue of the prior conviction. Even if Mr. Yanez is held to a federal definition of the term of prior conviction and the prior final conviction, we admit, not under Gill, but under other precedent of this court, Graham and Gomez, that his first offender probation would be a conviction when you're on it or when it's discharged. So it was a conviction at the moment he pled guilty in 1998. But under federal law, we still believe he would have an argument on finality, that when he pled guilty to the violation of probation, although he couldn't appeal his original guilty plea, he still had direct appeal rights on the violation of probation. If he were to vacate the violation of probation and he prevailed on that, he'd be back in a situation where he would be on first offender probationary status, and he may not, and his case wouldn't be final. So he still had direct appeal rights, even though he had pled guilty in 1998 and had a violation of probation later on. And finally, Judge Rovner, in response to your question to counsel, it's not that the board couldn't change its position, but if it does, it has to give a reasonable justification for doing so. And our position is that the board hasn't done that, that the board essentially counted noses and looked at the sentencing guideline cases and said, well, there's a lot of those, so let's just move over to this side. And we feel that the board needed to do more if it really wanted to stress that its more interpretation had some rationale behind it. As a result, we think the rule should apply prospectively. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Ms. Palumbo. Thanks to both counsel. The case is